Welcome to the Class of 1987 podcast. I am your host, Tim Harkness. On this podcast, we will be speaking with members of the Yale College Class of 1987 about their lives, where they've been, where they are now, and where they are going. We plan to cover a wide range of topics and have people who represent the full range of our class's experience. The class of 1987 is the best class that Yale College has ever had, and we're here to celebrate that. So sit back and listen to what your classmates have to say.
All right. Welcome to the next edition to the Y87 podcast. With me is Catherine Elliott. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I think that this podcast series is a great idea. I've really enjoyed listening to several.
Well, it's been a real joy to do. So thank you for participating. So where are you and what are you up to these days?
Well, right now I'm in my classroom. I am in the Berkshires of Massachusetts, rural, western, southern Massachusetts. I live in the southernmost and westernmost town in Massachusetts, and I teach a little bit north of that. And it's a beautiful, beautiful part of Massachusetts. I feel very lucky to have landed here. And I've been here since 1989.
Wow. And so what is it that you teach?
I teach French because that's what I know and that's what I love. I grew up in a French-American family. My mom's French. My dad's of French descent. And I wanted to be a teacher. And really, that was the most important thing. And so after I figured that out, what should I teach? Well, teach what you know and teach what you love. So it wasn't a very difficult decision in terms of my subject matter.
Mm-hmm. And so what grades do you teach?
Right now, I teach middle school and I teach grade 7 and 8. That's my specialty. I really know a lot about that age group and I love them. Understand them very, very well. Love to hang out with 12 and 13 and 14-year-old kids all day long. However, I did spend the first part of my career teaching not only 7 and 8, but I taught 7 through 12. So I've taught, I taught for 18 years in a district to the south of where I am now. I taught 7th graders through seniors. I have dabbled a little bit in 5th and 6th grade, which I can do, but really my forte is 7th and 8th grade and above.
What is it about the 7th and 8th grade? What is it about that age group that you find?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, it's funny because sometimes I say, you know, I teach middle school and people just, you know, they bow to me like it's like, oh, you have sacrificed your life to be with those impossible humans who are full of pimples and attitude. But there are several reasons I enjoy it. They're full of energy. And energy is something that I use in the classroom. I channel their energy. It's kind of the opposite of, you might picture, you know, a group of high school students who are like sitting back in their chairs, looking like they're half dead. Middle schoolers are not apathetic in general. And another reason is that I think it's a very challenging time to be a human being. I don't think it's easy to transition from childhood to adolescence. There's a lot going on in terms of hormones and breaking away from you know, parental control and discovering identity. And you know, if you're going to do a job, might as well go where you're needed. And I feel that a middle school student is a very specific type of student. I think that they need a lot of kind, careful guidance from adults. And as a parent, the parents don't have decades of experience working with middle schoolers. They have 1, 2, 3, 4. They have their children and they do a wonderful job, the best job they can. But if you're working with this age group, you know, year after year, decade after decade, you really learn about them. So I feel that I've had a chance to become an expert in 12 and 13 year olds so that I can help them navigate that part of their life, which is really not easy for a lot of them.
You know, you're teaching French in the classroom, but it's not mm-hmm. just about the language. It's about
No. It used to be. When I first started teaching, it was very much about the subject matter. Teaching has just changed so much. And so I didn't talk to a lot of other teachers. I was in a classroom and the door was closed and I I did my thing. Not very well, I might add, because I didn't really know what I was doing. And it was about the French. We didn't really talk about the kids' social, emotional well-being, which is something that we do a lot now, a lot. And I'm glad that that's true. So nowadays, I'd say French is definitely secondary, and teaching the child is primary. Obviously, I want them to become proficient in French. I'd like them to reach a higher proficiency in French, but I certainly want them to be, you know, I want to help them navigate the anxieties that they're feeling, especially after COVID. COVID was a real hard blow to kids in terms of knowing how to be social with each other because they were isolated. And so when they came back from COVID, it was sometimes I felt like they didn't know how to be in groups anymore, which is part of what public schools do. They help students learn how to work in groups. So I'm really glad we're back in the classroom. So they sort of feel like we're re-socializing some of them, and kids are very resilient. So they're doing great now that we've had a few months into the year.
So, you know, you mentioned this evolution from the way you taught when you first taught and the way you think mm-hmm. about it now. How much was that your personal evolution, and how much of that was the change in the way that the school district you're working in has thought about its mission over time?
Oh, definitely both. But if I hadn't evolved personally along with the school, I probably would have quit or would have been fired, because there's an expectation now that we look at the whole child. And, you know, we have kids in crisis all the time. And if you're teaching, you know, math or French or whatever, our duty is not to just ask the kid to leave the room because it's not our problem. The kids are why we're here. And there's an expectation that we are going to take that seriously. Happily for me, I've embraced that. And I really do love supporting the kids in that way. I can't say that's true for all teachers my age who have been doing this for, you know, 30, 40 years. I think that there are a few who would prefer to focus on the content and less on what they consider counseling. I'm not a counselor. I don't pretend to be, but I do connect with kids. And I think that teachers are in an ideal place to connect with kids, and I relish that part of my job. But not everyone does. The good news is that because that's how schools operate now, that's the expectation. As young teachers join the profession, you know, they know from the get-go that we're here to support kids, and that doesn't just mean teaching them Spanish or art or whatever it is they're teaching. You're teaching the whole child about what it is to be human and resilient and getting along in this world, which is so complicated now.
So how does that change the way you approach planning for your daily classes? Like going from the just teaching the grammar to teaching the whole kid?
It's very funny you mentioned grammar, because I don't really teach grammar. That's what I used to do.
I learned French in a Catholic boys' school. So we started with the grammar.
In my opinion, that's not the way to go. Not every language teacher would agree with me, but I sort of hit a wall after year 15 and almost stopped teaching, because I felt that my students, you know, everyone thought I was a good teacher, no complaints from kids or parents, but the French wasn't just falling out of their mouths. And then I just did a lot of research. And if you look at the research, surprise, surprise, you can find out really important things. And so I've completely changed the way I teach, and it's not grammar based. Well, it's actually pretty simple. If you have kids, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, think about your kids when they were learning how to speak. You didn't sit them down when they were two or three and say, okay, let's conjugate the verb to be. To be, I am, you are, he is, we are, you are, plural. You know, you didn't do that. That's not natural. It's not, first of all, you don't learn a language. I mean, you did, maybe in your high school, you were learning a language, but that's not the way to go about it. You want to acquire a language. There's a huge difference. So, for example, if you learn a language, you're learning about it. You're learning that in German, you capitalize the nouns and the verbs often go at the end. You're learning about it. If you acquire language, you don't know any of that. It just comes out of your mouth because you say what you want to say. You say what sounds right. Mm-hmm. So I don't teach, I don't want my kids to learn French. I want them to acquire French. And it's a completely different way of teaching. And it's once you buy into it, it's fantastic. But if you've spent a long time, you know, teaching conjugations, it's a pretty big leap. And I can't say that all teachers are there, but they certainly are getting there. I'm mentoring a young, a wonderful young Spanish teacher, and she has fully embraced this, I don't want to say new way of teaching. It's just that it's, most people aren't doing it. I think that there are a minority of teachers who are using this approach, but she's embraced it and she's having great success because, you know, your kids grew up and they just spoke English because they heard it enough times with context that they, their brains acquired it. We all have, if you have a child or a person even with a brain that functions normally, the brain's hardwired to acquire language. One of the things that really bothers me the most about telling people that I, you know, speak French or teach French is some people make the assumption that that has something to do with intelligence, which is absolutely ludicrous because I'm sure that you might know one or two people you consider unintelligent who speak fluent English. I mean, maybe, you know, they say ain't, but they're getting their point across. They can speak English. So it has nothing to do with intelligence. It just has to do with the brain being hardwired to acquire a language.
Interesting. Interesting. So you talked a little bit about what COVID, how it's impacted kids. You know,
huge.
What were the biggest impacts you saw? And as you say, I'm a parent. I have one high school kid still at home. How should we be thinking about helping our kids get back into the world?
Well, the first thing I get upset when I hear people use the phrase catch up and to like make up for the lost time. So if you're talking about a child who's learning how to read and then they miss out on first grade and then half of second grade, you can't just speed up the process. Let's just say that child was in a house that didn't have a lot of books, and there are kids who have parents who read them books, and there are kids who have parents and there are no books in the house and no one reads to them. So the idea, and I hear a lot when I listen to the news, it bothers me that like the teachers in the schools need to catch the kids up. And I think what they mean by that is that if the kid missed all of first grade and all of second grade, that it's the school's job to catch them up so that by fourth grade, they're reading at a fourth grade reading level. Well, it doesn't work like that. You can't just accelerate learning how to read. So I think what we need to do is take the kids where they're at and go from there. And they're eventually going to learn how to read. But it's possible that for a few years, we're going to have kids who are perhaps not at what we would consider the grade level for reading. And that's because they missed out on a big chunk of it. And they weren't fortunate enough to be in a house with adults who were helping them get that, you know, to learn how to read. So that's probably the biggest thing is understanding it's not about catching up. And then the second thing that we need to do is to be patient and understand that the kids are, and I teach middle school, so I think it was less, my experience is that it was harder for elementary and middle school than for high school for various reasons. But in middle school, what I'm seeing is the kids are younger. So for example, my eighth graders are 13 and they don't act like what I would consider a normal 13-year-old. They act more like sixth graders. And here's a concrete example. There's Halloween. You know, I've been teaching middle school my entire career, long, long time. Eighth grade, they don't all do costumes. Some of them do costumes. It's not like, you know, fifth grade, everybody's got a costume. And this year, I couldn't believe it. Every single eighth grader had a costume, just like they were little kids, because they kind of are.
Yeah, they miss that stuff.
Yeah, they miss that stuff. And it was hilarious because I'm not used to seeing my eighth graders come in costumes. And we just have to remember that they missed out on a big chunk. So if their behaviors sometimes just seem odd. And I don't know if the parents notice that as much because they're with their kids. But if you've been teaching a certain age group, and you're really good at that age group, this whole new group of students come in and they're not actually behaving the way that age group normally behaves.
Yeah. How do you think about that? So helping people socialize, because as a parent, mm-hmm. you know, I certainly had expectations of what junior and senior high school would be. If we have mm-hmm. one child who's a first year student in college and one child who's senior in high school. So we did the end of high school with two kids through the pandemic.
Right.
And so I had expectations from our older mm-hmm. children about what that would be about. And clearly mm-hmm. like dances and going out with your friends.
Yes.
Like
that didn't happen. Huge. Yeah.
Like how I think as a parent, do you think about people like coaching them? Because you take this leap to go to college mm-hmm. without having those formative social experiences.
Oh, it's hard. It's hard. And I think that one of the things, unfortunately, and this is just, you know, anecdotally from, you know, people I've talked to, is that what happened is sometimes these young adults, these people who didn't have, I have nieces who are sophomores in college. So their experience was they had to do a COVID high school for the end of their high school, COVID graduation, and then their first year of college was all COVID. So they weren't actually at school. And one of the things is the going wild, like tremendous partying and not getting thrown into this situation that they've heard about for 2 years and were expecting to join a lot earlier, and then going overboard with the partying. And that does worry me a lot. And as I said, they're younger, they're behind. But the good news is I don't think it's going to take them that long to catch up. I don't think this is, you know, permanent damage. This year, I think after this year, we're going to be able to return to for what you would expect your kids in college, I would predict are going to have relatively normal in terms of what you expect for their sophomore, junior, and senior years. And it's sad that they missed out on a big chunk of that, because I, you know, treasure every moment that I was in school, and the thought of, you know, missing. Well, for me, things like the prom and graduation weren't a big deal, but they are a very big deal to some people, you know, and they missed out on those things. But they'll be able to do those rites of passages in the next couple of years, I think. Are your kids, have they been able to stay in person this whole year?
This year, yes. And, you know, and our son's in the dorm, except for a brief stay into mm-hmm. quarantine housing when he mm-hmm.
got sure.
So, yeah. And our senior in high school is in school mm-hmm. all year. And they were in school at the end of last year. So, you know, I think that relative to many, it's been good for them. So it's.
And they're resilient. I honestly, when I walk around the building, I think the kids are doing better than the adults in a lot of ways. They are more resilient. This was a hugely stressful, difficult time for teachers, especially the teachers who have taught for a while, where what you do is based 100% on being in a room with a live person. And that's what you do. And you don't know anything else, nothing. I mean, we didn't, you know, online learn, that's just, no one did on, sure, we used computers in class. So that was really, really hard, because of course what teachers care most about are their students. They want to provide quality lessons. So what happened to us is that you would have top-notch master teachers who were basically crap teachers because they didn't know how to teach online. It was really hard, and the kids didn't know how to learn online. They would just leave the room. You know, if I have a kid leave the room now, well, I go get him back. I mean, I had a kid today leave the room. I just walked down the hall and he came back in. But if they're online and the kid just logs off the class, there's nothing I can do. So I really feel that my colleagues, I feel that they're definitely still in recovery mode, more so than the kids. But, you know, they'll recover. We're all resilient. The kids are just, I love watching them be so resilient. It gives me a lot of hope.
True. It does. It does. I definitely see that from my kids and their friends. It does. Mm-hmm. They are bouncing back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So are there any things that you've learned from the need to switch to remote school then back that you're going to take forward? Is there anything that came out of all this?
Absolutely. There's always good that comes out of these very challenging, difficult situations. So I didn't use technology because I'm not into it. It's not interesting. And I pretty much ignored amazing resources that are available on the internet. And then because of COVID, I had to find things that I could assign to my students to do that were of quality and available through the computer. And it was very, 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 very time consuming because that's not what it's not the world that I know. But I have found great stuff that I'm using. Today I had the kids on the computers for about 10 minutes in each class. I found this thing called Edpuzzle, and it's basically YouTube videos. And then there's a teacher who takes the YouTube videos and then fiddles around with them so that there are questions that the kids can listen to and they can answer, and their answers are recorded. So because of COVID, my teacher toolbox is a lot better. I certainly don't think that all these internet activities would replace teaching in a classroom, but there's some pretty good stuff out there that's cool. And so I'm really glad that, you know, at my age, when I was kind of like, oh my God, I'm not going to like look on the internet for another thing, that I was forced to. And I'm thankful for that unexpected perk of COVID.
Fair enough. Yeah. And I'm finding that there are ways of working that are better. There are ways of working that are not better. They're worse. And so I can't wait for some degree to get back all the time into the office. But yeah, and a lot of my job is teaching like younger lawyers how to do it and how do you connect to what resources. Like that's, it's been an interesting journey. So what would you say your teaching philosophy is? You sort of touched on it before about teaching the whole kid, but are there sort of linchpins of or key foundational concepts that you try to apply every day?
Well, I guess I'd have to answer that with a question, because there's a philosophy of teaching and like what you want, why you're doing it. And then there's the pedagogy in terms of the approach that I take to teaching French, which is very specific, which has to do with something called comprehensible input. I'll try to answer both. My philosophy is that, like in the movie Ratatouille, which I do not show in class. I would never show that in class. It's not a French movie, but, you know, kids know it because it takes place in France. They say one of the characters, I think it's Chef Gusto. Somebody says, anyone can cook. Well, I think anyone and everyone can learn, and you never give up. I think you never, ever, ever, ever give up, and you have to keep digging deeper. Yesterday, I served as a translator for a family meeting. A family meeting is with a student adjustment counselor and a student and their family. And they needed me because the family is from the Republic of Congo and the parents don't speak English, they speak French. And this student, this girl, a seventh grade girl, is a mess, failing all her classes. We couldn't figure out what was wrong. And our amazing, amazing student adjustment counselor worked with her and then called this family meeting. And what we found out was that she felt that her parents didn't want her. She thought that because there was a big age difference between her and her older siblings, that she was a mistake and unwanted. And she felt like she was a big disappointment. And the parents had no idea. It was really intense. Tears. So after that meeting, and I was like, oh, big deal. Today, the social adjustment counselor came to find me and said, lo and behold, this girl had a great day. She seemed happy. She was doing her work in class instead of avoiding it. She was a different person. So you have to never give up. You have to, and it doesn't matter how obnoxious or rude or how many times the kid flips you off or they say, you know, F you, you have to just stay with them because, you know, they all have good there. It's just sometimes takes a lot of patience to get there. So I would say that's my philosophy. And then in terms of my pedagogy, when it comes to teaching a language, don't teach through grammar. Teach the way the brain wants to acquire language.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you are enjoying the conversation. As you listen, please think about acknowledging the generosity of our guests for sharing their lives. Leave a comment.
tell a friend, post about what you've heard on social media, maybe sign up to be a guest yourself. The discussions we have on this podcast are made all the richer with your participation. Now, back to the conversation.
And you learned that through looking at cognitive psychology, that kind of thing?
I learned it because what I was doing didn't work. And so I started doing research and brain-based research. And I majored in linguistics. So, you know, I took classes on language acquisition. And I had some knowledge of how languages are acquired. But really, it's still pretty much a big mystery. I mean, that's the reason it's, you know, what did they call them? Group one, two, three, four?
Yeah.
Like, it was a group three, which are social sciences, and it wasn't, was it four that was science and math?
Yeah.
So like it wasn't, so, and basically group three means like it's not hard science, it's soft science. And we don't really, really, really know. But we know a lot more than we used to. And so I did the research and talked to a lot of people, and I found out that there was this linguist, his name is Stephen Krashen, who had a theory of language acquisition. And a few teachers had perked up their ears. And by that time, we did have the internet, luckily. So I was able to connect with these people. And they were saying, hey, we're doing this crazy new thing. Like, it's, you won't believe it, but it's working. And so at the time, it's changed now. Now it's called CI, which is comprehensible input. At the time, it was called, I can't remember now. The natural approach? I'm not sure. It's changed over the years, but it really was in the 70s and 80s. But I started teaching in the 80s and I didn't know about it because I hadn't done my research. So happily, my frustration and not being able, my students weren't proficient. And happily, I found out about this. And even though people thought I was insane because I wasn't teaching conjugations, I did it anyway and it worked. And now people don't question me anymore because the kids are speaking instead of conjugating verbs.
Right. Yeah, there's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. You don't go around the street, hello, I am, you are, it is.
That's true. That is definitely true. So what's it like dealing with the parents?
They're mostly great. I mean, I think most people are great. I mean, do I have incredibly wild, insane stories about difficult parents? Of course I do. Of course I do. That's part of the job. I have to admit, though, the administrators protect the teachers from the crazy parents. I know that happens a lot. Sometimes, you know, you can, here's an example. You'll have a school committee meeting and it'll be on Zoom. It doesn't happen in person because this doesn't happen in person as much, but on Zoom, you know, you'll have parents who join the meeting and then speak at the meeting and they're completely drunk or stoned or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you have to give them the time. You give them their 2 minutes or whatever. Everyone realizes they're completely drunk and you still have to give them their time because everyone gets their 2 minutes to comment if it's a public comment session. And so if we have a parent with something that's really off the wall, the administrators, well, if they call us first, then we, you know, we deal with it. But oftentimes people think like, oh, I'm going to go to the top. And so they contact the principal or superintendent. And in a lot of those cases, the teacher doesn't know about it. But sometimes the parents do contact us directly. And I mean, this is a minority. This is not most parents, you know, but hey, you know, there are difficult people and you just have to not get defensive and be very, very polite. And then one important thing, this is what I do a lot of mentoring of young teachers or new teachers, is there is a point where you need to turn the matter over to your principal, and then the principal will at some point say, do not respond to the email, do not respond to the phone call, because it's just not going to go anywhere. But the vast majority of parents, they're really want the best for their kids, and they're supportive. Some of them are not comfortable in schools because they had a bad experience in school. That happens a lot with French, because so many people say that they had a horrible experience learning a language when they were young, because actually it was really badly taught. And so one of the things we try to do is to make it a safe place for people to come in and ask questions and email. So one of the things that teachers are graded in Massachusetts, we had, there's a rubric and there are five standards. And one of the standards that we're evaluated on is communication with families, because that's really important. You can help a child, but if the school and the family partner together, you can help the child a lot more.
Yeah. Is there a teacher, a particular teacher who inspired you?
Oh, of course. Yes. So many. My first grade teacher, well, I went to school in France and also in the US, so that I had like most of kindergarten was in France and all of my ninth grade was in France. In the States, my first grade teacher was Mrs. Ingram, and I'll never forget it. I was learning how to read, and I just look, and the words, it was just this soup. It was just this soup. I was like, I couldn't figure out the word. And then she said, well, look, what's the first letter? And then I said, G. And she said, what's the last letter? And I said, G. And she said, well, you know those. You just need to figure out what's in the middle. And the word was going. And I just was like, you know, I won the lottery. I don't know. Well, how does a first grader feel when they're really happy? I'm not quite sure how to describe it. But it was just like, it was so clear. Like, I could read it. It went from this sea of letters that meant nothing to the word going. And, I was just so, so happy. And then at Yale, I had a professor. I had Richard Goodkin. I think he's at the University of Wisconsin now, in a small seminar. And I'm more of a, well, now I'm talking about something I love and that I'm knowledgeable about, so I'm talking a lot, but I tend to be more of a listener. And he was really one of the only professors at Yale who was really good at having a discussion and getting every student to contribute, not just the loud, confident ones, because I wasn't confident and I had pretty much pretty big inferiority complex. Inferiority, I felt very inferior at Yale. And in his class, he does what I hope I do in my classes, which is to make everyone feel safe and accepted. And he really brought out my voice in a way that I don't think that any other professor, you know, was able to. It was really beautiful. In fact, I think I need to write him a letter.
I think you would appreciate that. And I have to say,
you're right.
I think there are many classmates who felt inferior at Yale.
I know that now, of course.
No, I didn't. I mean, I felt like I didn't voice that feeling for years.
Mm-hmm. Like, I know, me too.
Somebody said it to me once. I was like, oh yeah, I felt that way too.
I'm
like,
wait. I wish we talked about it more, because I get together. Oh, I'm sorry. We have an announcement on the PA.
About a possible.
Oh, here's a teacher moment. There is an announcement right now. I think they're going to announce no school for tomorrow.
Oh, because of the weather.
Yeah.
Snow day happen. And here are.
This is Project Connection. It's a wonderful after school program from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. That is really geared towards families who need a place for their children to be that's safe with adult supervision. So this is just the director of Project Connection. He's just being funny. He's just telling kids that if they want a snow day tomorrow, they should wear their pajamas inside out and that sort of thing. So he's just being funny.
It's funny. It's just, so one of the things that my children were outraged by was an announcement by the school. They were trying to say, like, oh, remote school is going to be great. And by the way, it means we never have to miss school again.
Right.
And they thought that was like a moral abomination, that they've been robbed. And
I get it. We did this experiment that didn't work that well with these things called blizzard bags, where at the beginning of the year, we would make these plastic bags full of work for the kids to do, and they took them home. And then if we had a snow day, they were supposed to do what was in the bag, and then that would count as school and we wouldn't have to make it up. What was great about it is that quite a large number of families, the parents told the kids, you will not do your blizzard bag work. This is a snow day. Go out and play in the snow. Because if you live in a you know part of the country where you've experienced snow days, you know it's just a pretty exciting thing. I am just as giddy over snow days as I was when I was 12, for sure.
I bet.
And there's the people are saying 60% chance for us tomorrow because of ice. We'll see.
Well, yes, we will see. We have the same prediction here. So let me just ask you one more question, and we're going to get to our lightning round. Are you fundamentally optimistic or pessimistic about the state of U.S. education? So you're optimistic.
Yeah,
Where does the optimism come from?
Well, I think you have to understand that the stuff that makes the news is going to be negative. I mean, you know, this doesn't make a headline. And picture this headline. Schools are doing okay. You know, like most of the kids are fine. You could do a headline if things are incredibly good, but it's not like things are incredibly good. You know, things are pretty good. I think that the quality of education is better than when I started. I mean, it certainly is for me, but when I look to see what my colleagues are doing, you know, it's better. What hits the news is just the awful stuff because it's newsworthy. And there's another interesting thing that if you poll families about the quality of the schools where they live, if you ask, I can't remember the exact numbers, if you ask people, you know, do you think that the schools, the public schools in the United States are high quality schools, then the percentage answer is pretty low, like I think in the 30s, maybe in the 20s. But if you ask them, do you think that the kids, the school that your kids go to, your own schools in your town, then the parents rate them much higher, because they know the teachers, they see what's going on. And I think there's a lot of great stuff happening. Is the system is broken in a lot of ways, but I think that you can say that for medicine, what's going on in terms of some people being able to access healthcare and others not. I mean, that's happening too, but it's not a total disaster. And I'm really excited about the young people going to profession. And hey, I forgot to tell you, this is actually why I was happy to be on your podcast, is that I don't see a lot of Yaleys being in the classroom, you know, for an entire career. And I'd like to point out that I'm a teacher. I'm not an educator. An educator, that might be great, but it could be a lot of things. It could be an administrator. It could be a consultant. It could be a superintendent. I'm a classroom teacher. I'm in the trenches. It's a fantastic job. So my hope is that maybe someone will hear this, and maybe their child or their niece will, nephew will say, hey, you know, I'd like to maybe become a teacher, and that they'll say, great, because believe me, I certainly didn't get that. What I've gotten, unfortunately, is you went to Yale and you became a teacher. Like, why'd you bother going to Yale? Which saddens me greatly. It really hurts my heart. And so I would just like to say out there publicly, it's a great job. I would never change anything about my career choices. And public schools need smart, energetic Yaleys like you guys out there listening. So give it a thought.
So do you think it would be because some of our classmates are thinking about what's their second act or third act or fourth act? You know, but we're still as a class, mm-hmm. young.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think if people could think about classroom teaching as a thing to do?
Well, I think it's a pretty big reach. For me, that would be like saying, okay, so I'm going to retire at the end of I'm going to retire in June of 2023. That's my retirement date. So I'll be 58. And I could have a second act. So if you consider, and I'm not just talking about like working in education, I'm talking about being a classroom teacher in a public school. So for me, that would be like saying, okay, so you're going to finish teaching. And then for your second act, you're going to be a nurse. Like, okay, it doesn't just happen that fast to become a teacher. It's a commitment, and sure, you could do it, but it takes a long time to really, it's hard. It's a hard job. Yeah, it's meaningful and all that. So I think that, yeah, could you volunteer in a school? Could you be a paraprofessional? That can happen pretty quickly. And could you become a teacher? Yes, but you're not going to be a good teacher for many years. And that's, and the longer you teach, the more you know that you keep getting better. You're okay after 5 or 10 or whatever, but you really get better. It's like Malcolm Gladwell, you know, the outliers, when he talks about the 10,000 hours.
Right.
Oh, does that matter in teaching? Big, big time. People who have taught the same age group, same content for, you know, 20, 25, 30 years, you know, they get to a level that you just can't get to in 5, 10, 15. So yes, education, public education, helping out the schools, you'd have to have a lot of energy, certainly more than I have now at my age. it's a big deal. I mean, it might look easy from the outside to manage that many kids. It's pretty, I mean, I love it, but I have seen many, many people start and quit after a day. We had one person last year quit before the first day. Because it's, you know, it's just, it's not for everyone. You need to, you know, have to have a really solid core inside of you, because kids, they can eat you up alive and spit you out at any school, you know, not just inner city schools, any school, you know, kids can, they know they have, the kids have the power. So you have to be able to work with that. I'm really more interested in talking to the children of my colleagues. And I hope that if any of the children, I mean, my classmates, the children of my classmates, that if any of the class of 87, they hear that their kid is interested in teaching, that they would not just shoot that down, because it's a fantastic career.
Terrific. Terrific. So let me ask you some lightning round questions
here. Because I've been listening to your podcast, like, oh my gosh, it's going to be the lightning round. What's he going to ask me?
Here we go.
I'm a little nervous. I'm nervous.
Don't be nervous. Okay. When the pandemic is over and you can go back to France, where are you going to go?
Well, that's easy. My family is from France. My family's from a town called Nancy, which is in the province of Lorraine in the northeastern part of France. So I would go directly to Nancy to see my aunt Francine and my aunt Anne-Marie and cousins. And then after that, you know, Paris is my favorite city. I've spent many, many, many visits in Paris. But first I'd go to Nancy to see family.
Very nice. So are there any words or phrases in French that encapsulate ideas that don't really exist in English, but you think we should have them?
Oh, yeah. It's bon courage. It means good courage. It doesn't really make sense in English. Bon courage. So if someone is going to do something, they're about to do something that might present some challenges, it's a way of saying, you know, you can do it. Bon courage. Like, you'll make it. Have courage. And the words are bon, good, and courage, courage. But good courage just doesn't make sense. So, you know, bon courage is one that I sometimes want to say to people, but it just doesn't come out right in English. So I just say in French and they don't know what I'm talking about. And that's okay too.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And are there ideas or phrases in English you think that the French could use, or do you not think about it?
Oh, well, there's one that the French are jealous of, which I forgot the word in French because it's just so bizarre, but the French love leap year, because like there's this, you have this image of just, I don't know really where it came from, but you leap over, and I don't know what you leap over, but you know, we have a leap year and then we have a leap day, and they just think that's the coolest thing, because I wish I knew what it was in French, but it's something that's just like really boring. It's just not a cool word, and a leap day and a leap year is just a fun image. I love it.
So if we were going to serve a French food, mm-hmm. like a true French food, mm-hmm. at the reunion, what should we be serving?
Well, I could have steak frites, which is, you know, steak and fries. That's certainly not considered gourmet. That's what you would get at a cafe. The thing about French food now is there's, you know, in France now, it's not the France of the 50s. And I believe, you know, you'll have to fact check me on this, but I think that France might be the most racially diverse country in Western Europe right now. So they're like, when you asked me that, I was going to say couscous just because I love couscous so much. And that's from Morocco. But I think the Yale reunion would really like a good couscous. So I think I'm just going to say couscous. You know, maybe with a like a merguez couscous with the merguez sausages or even a chicken or lamb couscous because it's just so delicious. But it is from Morocco, which is a French-speaking country, but only so because of colonialism, of course.
Yes.
I had a Moroccan student, and my Moroccan student, she loved couscous, so she'd probably approve.
Perfect, perfect. Well, thank you very much for taking the time. This has been great.
This has been so much fun, and I really am enjoying listening to the podcast, and I think I passed my lightning round.
Yes,
it was perfect. I'll be able to sleep tonight.
All right.
My husband was trying to come up with like, oh, he might ask you, you know, your favorite book. You got to know your favorite book. Like, I'm not going to worry about this.
Yes. Well, I thought the French thing would be good. So the one question I did want to go back to is mm-hmm. the philosophy question, because mm-hmm. I was just a little concerned that there was enough personally identifying information about the student. I want to make sure you're comfortable talking about that experience. You didn't use the person's name. I think it was a girl. I don't remember exactly.
I think all I said was girl.
Yeah. But then you described the, you know, it was very personal. So if you're okay with that.
No, that's fine. We can't use names.
That kind of anonymized story is fine.
No, absolutely. I mean, that would be like, you know, me telling you that, you know, we have a student and his father's incarcerated. I mean, it could be any number of people.
Right. That's fine. I just want to make sure you're
comfortable. No, thank you. Thank you for checking. I appreciate it.
Yeah. No, it was great. And I didn't mean to suggest in my question, by the way, that it'd be easy to teach because I've coached teams. I was a swim coach right
now. Yeah.
In a world where people were isolated by a pandemic, forced to live their lives remotely in an endless parade of Zoom meetings, one Yale College class dared to break the mold. The Yale College class of 1987 is planning what no Yale College class has ever tried before, at least not for a while, an in-person reunion, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2022. We will be gathering in Pearson College. Be there for engaging discussions, nightly revelry, and way too much New Haven pizza, if there ever could be such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. It's one Yale College class dared to break the mold. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.